The following is an impromptu classroom discussion addressing why marijuana is unlikely to ever be approved for medicinal use in the United States. The presentation is from part of a larger lecture on psychopharmacology, providing background for the study of drug addiction. This particular topic addresses the Controlled Substance Act, Drug Enforcement Administration regulation of controlled substances in the United States. The conversation is joined in progress, addressing off-label prescribing privileges in America.
Off-label prescribing means that it's been approved for one usage, now it can be used for something else. Usually physicians aren't monitored closely. That's good, because that allows physicians to move ahead of FDA approval. That allows physicians to tailor treatment for individual patients. Most people don't respond well to a certain drug. They don't show the clinical outcome that's desired with that drug treatment. But I have five people in my practice of 500 that do, and they do consistently. It seems to be working. I don't care whether that's placebo or not. They're feeling better. I'm going to keep giving them that drug. But that drug may not be approved by the FDA. That's also at the root, I think, of why you'll never see medical marijuana. You're never going to see this happen. You have to understand, first of all, that federal laws trump state laws every time. If a state gets together and says, oh, that's going to be legal, or we're going to do this and not that, federal government says, no, you're not. And federal government has control over that. They have the final say. You heard of the American Civil War, perhaps, right? That's part of what that's all about. States' rights versus federal government rights. That's really what the war boiled down to. There are certain issues in that, but the main thing had to do with who gets to make their laws. In Alabama, when the governor stood on the footsteps of the entryway to the university and said, blacks will not be admitted to this university, federal government sent in troops to enforce federal law. When they refused to bus in Boston and to take people from economically disadvantaged areas that were predominantly African-American at the time and allow them access to the better schools with the better teachers in other parts of Boston, Boston people said, we're not going to bust. It's too expensive, too much nuisance. And what happened is the federal troops went into Boston. That's back in the 80s. This is not in a, 1912 era, 1914. That was fairly recent. Federal laws trump. More recent one that your parents will remember, or your grandparents, driving. Maximum speed limit in the United States was 55 miles an hour. In the 1970s, because of an oil embargo, we ran low on oil. And one way to save gasoline is to drive slower. You should know that already, right? Don't accelerate fast. Don't drive fast down the highway. You save gasoline. And you may only save 5 or 10%. Well, who's going to notice that in my wallet at the end of the week? I want to get there fast. I'm in a hurry. But when you add that up with millions of drivers in the United States, that's a significant number of barrels of oil each day. So the federal government imposed a national speed limit of 55 miles an hour. Wyoming. You ever been to Wyoming? It's a long ways between towns. My aunt, just a nice conservative little old lady, got in her Buick Roadmaster, and she just put the pedal to the metal and cranked 85 miles an hour all the time across those prairies. It's a long distance between towns. So Wyoming says, no, we're not. We're not going to enforce those speed limits. That's not practical in Wyoming. Federal government said, fine, we're going to keep all your federal tax money that goes for highway. You have to maintain your own roads. See, federal government takes the tax money, and they dole it back to states and certain programs. So the federal government has control over how that money is spent. They take in tax money for the roads, off gasoline tax, and then they give it back to the states to build highways. But the federal government then has a muscle they can flex to say, you're not going to allow people in your schools in Boston, or you're not going to allow minority students in the University of Alabama. Fine. We're going to withhold your federal funds. Okay, that's not enough. We send in federal troops. They activate federal troops with their guns. They go down there and they enforce it. Now, why do I tell you all this? Well, this actually has to do with drug regulation and control and drug scheduling, as you see in the end of Chapter 4. Do you understand already why we won't have medical marijuana? I've been teaching this for 10 years. It's real simple. Marijuana is a Schedule 1 substance. What that means is to have access to that drug, forget prescribing, just to be able to obtain that drug, you have to have what's called a Schedule 1 license. A Schedule 1 license with a DEA is different than a Schedule 2 through 4 license, which is what most people would have, a prescribing physician or a pharmacy. That allows them to buy and distribute drugs under certain restrictions that are set up by the federal government. The Legislative Act is the Controlled Substance Act. But the government agency in charge with enforcing it is the Drug Enforcement Administration, or DEA. So they actually do all the paperwork, and they can make rulings that are short-term that act faster than what Congress would get together and make a new law banning a drug or restricting its access. Now, the DEA has, from following the FDA's guidelines, put marijuana in a Schedule 1 category because marijuana is a drug which has a high abuse liability. Do you understand it has a high abuse liability? Do you understand the difference between abuse and addiction? Marijuana may not be addictive. But for the sake of argument, let's say it's not addictive like cocaine and heroin. And if you're scheduling 1 through 5, certainly marijuana is not more addictive than cocaine or morphine. Very few people would argue that. Although I'm sure there's somebody in the government that says, oh, yes, it is. But most people wouldn't say marijuana is more addictive than morphine and cocaine, even though they might argue it's addictive. So Schedule 1, which is above 2, doesn't imply it has a higher addiction liability. It doesn't necessarily even have a higher use liability. But let's look at how this works. Abuse liability is misuse. And here's the way the experiment would work under my design, ideally, which would get me in trouble and probably arrested. I would take about a gram or two of marijuana, 10 grams. What do you buy when you buy marijuana? I don't know. Gram at a time? Gram? Okay, gram marijuana. Put it in a little watch glass so we can do a little show and tell, send it throughout the class. If I take marijuana, a gram of that, and I start in the front row and I pass it around, row to row, you all look at it, sniff it, you know, don't touch it now, but, you know, sniff it, and you pass it on to the next person up through the back, and then they pass it back to the front. I'm willing to bet that if I weighed that out and weighed 1 gram when it started, it would be a little light when it came home, okay? It might weigh half a gram, might weigh, you know, 0.9 grams, or it might weigh 0.1 gram. Depends on how many people step on it, you know, take out a little sample, you know, a little something to smoke in between their classes today, and before it got back to me. That drug has a high abuse liability. Do you understand? That's a misuse. Government says any use of marijuana is not legally sanctioned. It's misuse. You're not permitted to take it recreationally, and you're not permitted to take it medicinally because medicinal effects are not recognized. So any use of marijuana is misuse. So it has a high abuse liability, any way that you term that. Nobody disagrees with that unless you want to say, oh, it's okay to get stoned and marijuana shouldn't be in there at all. But it has a high abuse liability. Now, it also has no recognized medicinal use. And that means it's Schedule 1. Schedule 1 are drugs which have a high abuse liability and no medicinal use. It doesn't mean they have a high addiction liability. And it certainly doesn't mean they have a higher addiction liability than compounds which have a lower numerical ranking, which is the way you normally interpret the chart. It's like a golf score. The lower the score, the better. So Schedule 4 substances have a lower abuse liability than Schedule 3, which is lower than 2, which is lower than 1. No, that's not true. That's where the rules come in different. Schedule 1 is just a high abuse liability, period. It doesn't rank order the substances in that category. High abuse liability with no recognized medicinal uses. That includes marijuana. That includes LSD. That includes psilocybin and the other hallucinogens. That includes heroin, because heroin in the United States has no recognized medicinal use, because after all, you could take what? Morphine. That's the same thing. The only difference is you have to take 3 or 4 times larger doses of morphine than what you would take of heroin, and that relates to potency, which is what I'll come to shortly. But as far as medicinal uses go, they're the same drug, and they should be, because heroin is converted to morphine in the brain, and the morphine binds at the opiate receptor, not the heroin. So that makes perfect sense from a chemical, medicinal, and pharmacological standpoint. So it's perfectly logical. Of course, you know they're different on the street for addicts, and that's one of the reasons that the DEA, in all their wisdom, they know it's different too. They put that as a Schedule 1 drug, high abuse liability, but no recognized medicinal effect. So heroin Schedule 1, just like marijuana, is Schedule 1 in LSD. Where's cocaine? Cocaine is a Schedule 2 substance. You could actually get a prescription for cocaine. Your pharmacy could stock cocaine. It's Schedule 2. I think that's absurd, personally, because I think other drugs, you have to use a couple of them, will do the same thing cocaine will do. But it's still approved for ophthalmology. They can use it because it's a local anesthetic. You know that already. And I also mentioned it's a vasoconstrictor. So when you're doing surgery, and we do this in rats too, we're doing surgery and you slice open some tissue and it starts bleeding, you can put the local anesthetic combined with vasoconstrictor down and it will take care of any minor pain that the subject may be experiencing, and it will constrict the veins or really arteries that then retard the drug flow, which increases the coagulation. In other words, it decreases the clotting time. causes it, the blood to stop flowing and you don't bleed. And we could use cocaine. It has local anesthetic plus vasoconstrictor properties. Of course, we don't get to do that in the laboratory, and the brain surgery I do. We use a combination of lidocaine or procaine, which are local anesthetics like the dentist would use, just as good as cocaine. And we put in some epinephrine, which is a vasoconstrictor. So we put two drugs together, make a combinational drug that now have local anesthetic effects with vasoconstriction. So why cocaine is a Schedule II substance, because it has those two properties too, escapes the wisdom of this professor, at least. Nonetheless, it is. I don't know pharmacies that have it. I don't know people that prescribe it. But technically, they could write a script for you to have a little cocaine because you're having a hard time staying awake in my classes. Oh, they can't do that. Yeah, it's called off-label prescribing. That's exactly what I'm coming back to now with our discussion of marijuana. If marijuana were to be recognized by the Food and Drug Administration to have medicinal effect, and if they were to decide that those medicinal effects outweigh the risk of having marijuana available by prescription, then they could reschedule marijuana as Schedule 2, even Schedule 3. By the way, if you read through the table that I have, you'll see the really difference between 2, 3, and 4 has to do with how much record keeping they have to do and has to do with what kind of safes you have. I'd have a special GL30 class safe for my Schedule 1 compounds, which is different than my Schedule 2 compounds. Couldn't be kept in the same physical space. The records had to be kept in a different notebook. They're watched more tightly. If marijuana is approved by the FDA for medicinal use and rescheduled then for, say, Schedule 2, where physicians could write a prescription to use marijuana in the treatment of neuropathic pain, which is one of the areas that it appears to be effective in. Neuropathic pain is that kind of pain that is associated with MS, fibromyalgia, other conditions that respond less well to even conventional opioids, and certainly conditions that you'll have to go up in the level of heavy medication fairly early for some types of neuropathic pain. Diabetes, often associated with neuropathic pain. So you could write a script for marijuana for neuropathic pain. That's fine. Works for that. Maybe for the anti-nausea effect that people experience with chemotherapy when they have cancer, getting treatment for that. The anorectic effect where they lose their appetite with chemotherapy and they start wasting away because they can't eat. They just have no appetite. Can't keep their food down. Smoke a little joint. Many of you probably already read someplace. It's an appetite stimulant. Gives you the munchies, I think the common expression would be. So now we write a script. We write it for our chemotherapy patients. We write it for our patients suffering from neuropathic pain, from fibromyalgia, from MS and so forth, even diabetes. Now you come into my office. You get really nervous before Professor Bozarth's exams. You know the material, but you get over-aroused, like we'll talk about in the second module when we talk about over-aroused effects and a decrement of performance. If you could just calm down a little bit. It's like the example I gave you early on where I talked about my friend that took a few shots of whiskey before the exam. Now, I write it for you because I know you're over-aroused. You'd do much better on the exam if you just take the edge off a little bit. We had the first winner of a gold medal for the snowboard that was accused of having THC in his bloodstream. In other words, smoking marijuana. People say, oh, no, no way, man, that would never happen. In fact, the entire Canadian government and the Addiction Research Institute up there came out saying, no way, no way. I mean, it's a gold medal for Canada. They don't win that many. So the whole government got behind that. Kid wasn't cheating. He didn't do it. And besides, here's the big argument. Besides, marijuana is a response impairing drug, right? It would screw up his performance on the snowboard. Well, I kept shut because I was a landed immigrant in Canada, and I like Canada. And I think they need a gold medal, you know, boost the national morale a little bit. But if he got just the right dose, just the right dose to take the edge off a little bit. I haven't downhill skied a lot, but I have been on the Black Diamond slopes in Steamboat Springs and going down a few of those. I point them downhill and just roll because I can't really ski, don't know how to turn. But you go really fast. It just scares the hell out of you. And I think these guys are a little bit nervous about going down the hill really fast. So if you take the edge off just a little bit and relax and get in the groove, as the saying goes, I even had a few times that I made it all the way to the bottom, almost, without crashing and spilling in a serious way, okay? Just relaxed, got in the groove, and just did it. You know, I went for it, okay? So maybe it was a response improving drug under certain circumstances. So let's come back to your test anxiety. So you got test anxiety, but you'd do much better and maybe even get into med school, like it's your dream and so on and so forth, if only you could take the edge off. And I'm a sympathetic physician, so I say, okay, I got a drug that might work for you. All you do is you smoke a joint right before the exam, maybe even like a half hour before. So you come down off the peak effect, but you still have that kind of mellowed out, relaxed, everything's cool, you know, attitude. Right, you listen to reggae all of a sudden, you know, everything's beautiful. And you're going to go into the exam now and cruise right through it. So I write it for you. Your buddy finds out that you're getting scripts for marijuana for the test exam. And it's not just the exam. It's also your study time where you'd benefit. It's also when you have to go home and visit your parents. You can take the edge off that a little bit. You need more money. They don't want to give it to you. You know, what did you do with the money you had? You know, take the edge off a little. So what happens is it starts being used for this reason, that reason, and the other reason. In other words, there's nothing built into the system that would restrict its use just to what it's approved for, which might be the treatment of neuropathic pain. People could start writing off-label prescriptions for treatment of test anxiety, treatment of parent anxiety. All my students intimidate me. You know, I could use a couple of totes on a joint before I came in. And it's a wonder drug all of a sudden. You know, it's the new vitamin D. It's going to help as an analgesic, your sugar levels, and everything else. It's never going to be out there. It's never going to be out there. And you got one more factor that goes on there for another reason. It relates back to the one I just told you. Do we need another legal intoxicant? Do you really understand that if alcohol right now were a drug being studied by the FDA that was not legal in the United States, it would be very unlikely that alcohol would be a non-controlled substance that would be made available without prescription? And in fact, it wouldn't be available by prescription because there's no recognized medicinal use. So alcohol would be banned in the United States in all likelihood with current attitudes about intoxication and so on and so forth. I know, I just drink to relax. Well, I'll take the alcohol out of it and see if you drink as much. The alcohol has a reinforcing effect. It has a desirable effect. It has effects which people find are deemed desirable. If you consider now that there's no breathalyzer for marijuana, we don't have a breathalyzer. Alcohol, another learning point, this deals with pharmacokinetics. Alcohol levels between the bloodstream and the lung gases equilibrate. They reach a point of equilibrium where one goes up, the other one goes up. One goes down, the other goes down. They don't have to be the same number. They just correlate with each other. That is because alcohol, being extremely volatile, comes out of the blood like carbon dioxide would come off the blood when you exhale. So you exhale alcohol when you've been drinking. Well, you've been drinking a lot, even if you haven't drank for a couple of hours, and you have that alcoholic breath is not coming from alcohol that's in your mouth, even alcohol necessarily in your stomach. All the mouthwash that you use, it's not the alcohol coming up from the throat or in the mouth that they're smelling. It's the alcohol actually coming off the lungs. There's no way to get rid of that. And alcoholics have often a very characteristic smell that has to do with the alcohol being put off the lungs. And one of the methods we use in laboratory rats to get them intoxicated is you could put them in a jar and put alcohol in the bottom of the jar, like in a cotton gauze, put a little wire mesh so the rats get the little paws out of the alcohol, put a lid on it, put the rat in there for 30 seconds to a minute, the rat comes out drunk. They breathe in alcohol. Yeah, you can breathe it in. So there's almost some merit in this thing that my wife used to say, oh, I get drunk just from breathing your breath. I've been out on the town. Well, I don't know if you get intoxicated, but you could probably take in a little alcohol, just not psychotropic dose levels of alcohol. So coming back to this, you have a breathalyzer test. You could do a simple, quick, on-the-spot test, law enforcement specifically now, that can do a breathalyzer test that can tell if you've reached a blood level which would be declared legally intoxicated in a given state. New York State is one of the states that refused to lower the blood alcohol level to the national standard for deciding intoxication because they said, oh, New Yorkers, they can have like a couple tenths of a gram more in their blood than you can in California or Illinois or Massachusetts. And you know what the federal government said, right? No highway taxes for you this year, or highway funds, right? They're going to withhold highway funds. So New York very quickly complied with the national standards then. So the state legislature, again, got trumped by federal government. Happens all the time. That's one of the reasons federal taxes are so important in controlling individual states' behavior. And people that are kind of anti-central government will be also anti-IRS, Internal Revenue System, which is a feeling shared by most of us that don't like to pay taxes. Okay, that's your lecture on why marijuana is never going to be legal. There is no comparable test for marijuana. The blood gases do not equilibrate with the blood levels of marijuana. We're not going to have a test. Maybe somebody would get it on the spot, prick the finger and get a test, but now you're pricking the finger, taking blood. Somebody get an infection from that, and then the cop gets sued. So we're never going to have a test that could pull you over when you're driving and say, I think that guy's stoned on marijuana. Let's give him a quick test and decide if he's at the legal limit or not. We can do that with alcohol. So there's a couple of quick reasons right there. You think the government's ever going to approve a compound that gets you intoxicated for which we don't have an on-the-spot breathalyzer-type test? for which there's no recognized medicinal use. Even if there's a recognized medicinal use, other drugs can do the same thing, is the argument. They have something called dronabinol, which is a synthetic THC, which is now available through prescription. So you could get a little pill, which is like marijuana. It's the active ingredient, the primary active ingredient, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. So you can take a THC tablet, which will produce supposedly the same effects of marijuana. Of course, we happen to know about pharmacokinetics in the professor's course, and we know that you can take all the pills you want, but it will never be the same as smoking a joint, because the rate of onset has a lot to do with it. Also, being able to control that dose level very precisely. In other words, get the dose level up to where you want the effect, and when it starts going down, take a little bit more and go back up. Starts going down, take a little more. Can't do that with a pill, because the pills have a longer duration of action by virtue of the fact they're being absorbed more slowly from the stomach. So getting a dose response effect there is much more difficult. So the pills really wouldn't work the same way. Whether they would work enough the same way to be beneficial or not is debatable. I don't know if being a very popular clinically used drug today. If you don't smoke the dope, it just ain't the same. And I think anybody that's eating marijuana brownies can attest to that. You have to be very careful with that. Same reason you have to be careful drinking. You have a delayed onset of effect. It's been absorbed from the stomach fairly slowly. So it's being absorbed. Now you get high, you get intoxicated, you may even go to the point of losing consciousness. It's still getting absorbed from your stomach until it reaches the peak level. Dylan Thomas, famous Welsh poet, died by drinking himself to death. Went to the bar, shots of whiskey, and just drank until he dropped over dead. If the whiskey were taken intravenously, he couldn't have done that. Because before he reached the lethal dose, and he's doing repeated injections, he would have passed out from intoxication, severe intoxication. When you take it orally, you load your stomach up like a big reservoir. Now you got the effect. Oh, my God, I'm getting too stoned. Oh, my God, I'm getting sick. There's no way to turn it off. Yeah, you could try vomiting. Good luck, babe. You know, it kind of helps sometimes. But you're on the roller coaster until you're done with the ride. I hope that you're tracking that discussion and presentation of drug scheduling. That presentation of simple tests for alcohol versus marijuana, equilibration with blood gases. I hope you're tracking the reasons behind the fact that it is extremely unlikely there will ever be medicinal marijuana in the United States. It's a real simple, logical thing to me, no matter how many states get behind it and say we want it. Last I heard, there is 10, 12 states, 15 maybe now, I'm not sure what the number is, that have voted acts for medicinal marijuana. It's simply not going to be a fact. What may happen is what they do in the Netherlands, which is what the Obama administration initially did, and that is they tell the federal prosecutors not to prosecute these cases of marijuana possession unless the possession happens to also violate state laws. So in other words, they went into compliance with state laws by looking the other way. In the Netherlands, marijuana was never legal. It's not legal today. What happens is they just don't enforce the rules. Unless you're getting in trouble with it, they don't enforce the rules.
These podcasts are copyright 2012 by the Addiction Science Network. They are produced in collaboration with the State University of New York at Buffalo and are provided solely for educational purposes. Podcasts can be directly downloaded from www.addictionscience.net. Transcripts are also available for some podcasts at our website, as are other documents and commentaries regarding drug addiction and select topics on psychopharmacology. These podcasts can be copied and freely distributed as long as the source is acknowledged and provided they are not edited in a manner which changes the fundamental meaning of the selected passages when quoted out of context of the entire presentation. Correspondence from professional colleagues is welcomed and can be sent to info@addictionscience.net. We do not offer clinical services, nor do we usually have time to reply to questions emailed from the general public. When listening, please keep in mind that these podcasts are targeted for academic and professional listeners. Everyone is invited to share any information they find useful, but our target audience is not the general public. Finally, please note that the Addiction Science Network is the sole author of this work, and views and opinions expressed herein should not be construed as official policy of the State University of New York.